today I am with Greg Puy. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
He's the host of the French podcast Vlan, and we are going to interview Jason Silva. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
So Jason explores modernity and technology and how it both benefits and disrupts humanity. The pressure of this can impact our mental health, but it turns out moving past our comfort zone is cognitively beneficial. Blowing a mind boosts cognitive flexibility.
It does.
It does. Hey, you'll explain us how exactly.
Sure.
My first question is, at a time where we feel like so close to lose control of our technology with AI and other things, what's making you an optimist still?
Yeah. Thank you for the question. And thank you both for having me in this hybrid podcast conversation. You know, it's interesting. I feel a lot of resonance with the words of Kevin Kelly. So Kevin Kelly is one of the co-founders of Wired magazine. He's considered a technology maverick and futurist. And he uses the word or the term protopian to when discussing like his views of the future, his orientation. So it's not the same as being a utopian, you know, a utopian optimist that just assumes everything will be fine, or a dystopian that has just succumbed to doom and gloom and fatalism. But a protopian believes that, hey man, we may be flawed, stumbling primates, but when we work together, we are primates that can fly. So no doubt we're at a inflection point, a kind of intelligence explosion when it comes to things like artificial intelligence. I've been lecturing about exponential technologies for 10 years, so I feel like I've been talking about this for a long time. So I'm not really that surprised that the world is finally waking up to the pace of change, the pace of innovation. And there are some legitimate concerns, no doubt, when it comes to AI. Could go off the rails, you know. It could be weaponized. It could play out in ways that we can't even predict, you know, the so-called unknown unknown. But at the same time, like, I mean, look how far we've come. Look how fast we've gotten here. Like, we were crawling the savannas of Africa, and now we're like building space telescopes that can peer into the Big Bang. You know, I can call my mother with a device that Amber Case calls a techno-social wormhole opener. You know, the smartphone like just opens up a techno-social wormhole whereby space and time and geography collapse. And I can see another person and talk to another person across oceans, across continents. So I see technology all around me that, as Arthur C. Clarke said, is indistinguishable from magic. So creatures that engender things indistinguishable from magic can get their act together if they need to and if they want to. So, and the protopian view, I believe, is exactly that. It says, hey, man, if we get our act together, we have within us the capacity to, you know, as Stuart Brand said, we are as gods and might as well get good at it. So, it's not saying, there's no guarantee, I suppose, right? But my intuition and my feeling and I suppose my faith lies in us, in this being our finest hour and us rising to the occasion.
But at the same time, I mean, you cannot ignore that we live in a very individualistic society, and this goes, I totally agree with you. I mean, the human are stronger because they go together and because of language and all those things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, since the Enlightenment period, we are very much into this individualistic, and I when I listen to talk like Tristan Harris on AI, people are listening, and yet they are wondering, yes, but how can I take advantage myself of AI? So they are listening to Tristan saying, oh yeah, AI is super dangerous. And at the same time, wondering how they can take advantage of it because they don't want to be last. So, you know, the struggle, and that's to me is the issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's nothing new under the sun that technology is and has always been a double-edged sword. And so the alphabet, how wonderful this tool to encode human knowledge, to allow us to communicate, and you can weaponize language, writing, same thing. the printing press, how liberating, but also hate speech propaganda can really propagate itself through the printing press. Same with social media. Without social media, I know that my career wouldn't really have been possible, and the hearts and minds that I touch through my work that thank me for the ways in which my work has served their life wouldn't be possible for that, were it not for that medium, for that technology. But we've seen the weaponization of social media. We've seen what it did to the United States in the elections. We've seen how it was used, Cambridge Analytica. We've seen what happened with Brexit. I mean, incredibly problematic stuff. And I guess that's just the story of man, unfortunately. The story of humanity is, in some ways, we are Promethean beings and we steal fire from the gods, but perhaps we got ahead of ourselves. We didn't have the wisdom and the prudence, as Daniel Schmachtenberger said, to utilize, to deploy these tools in the best of ways. We sort of just deploy them and the use cases happen, and some are good and some are bad. And maybe we need to get ahead of that before the tools are world-shaking and world-destroying tools.
Who should be the wise men we're trusting?
Yeah, good question. In terms of like who do we listen to is probably the toughest question of all. And I talk about this as well, that human beings are, well, we're storytelling animals, and our compass, our the way we orient ourselves, the way we orient our behavior, the thing that tells us how to act in the world is a storytelling structure, you know, like it seems to be like at the very bottom of consciousness is story. You know, meaning is extracted from story. And so these narratives, these stories, they sustain us or they can destroy us. You know, there's nothing more tragic but also fascinating about somebody who chooses to take their own life, especially in the Western world where we have secured such material prosperity, such material wealth, something that our ancestors would have like dreamed about, you know, cell phone, internet, communication, whatever, cable television. And that today more people die by suicide than die from natural disasters and armed conflict combined. Well, suicide is a crisis of storytelling, in my opinion. When the story you tell yourself about yourself is no longer convincing. When the narrative that sustains your life, when the narrative that gives your life meaning collapses or gets inverted or gets corrupted like a software file. Well, if you don't have a story, you can't live. You know, man can live a few, you know, weeks without food, a few days without water, but not for a minute without hope. Not for a minute without a sustaining narrative. And so the narrative matters. Jamie Weil during the Harvest Conference talks about when people come together and are like jolted into aliveness by something called soul force. It's the thing that wakes us up, you know, this affirmation of life in spite of its tragedy. And he cites people like Martin Luther King, you know, potentially Nelson Mandela. And these are people who in the end were orators. I think about Barack Obama, you know, the best story wins, and the best storyteller in a way casts a spell upon his or her audience. And so it's a great question. And, you know, I love language. I love literature. And I love poetry. And so I want the best storyteller, or the storyteller that wins, to be a very literate one. I want an inspirational voice that becomes the voice we all orient our lives around. But I don't want it to be an ideological voice. I don't want it to be a populist voice. I don't want it to be a voice that separates us, that casts us into a world of us versus them. I want a unifying voice that sees the other as oneself and that at the same time celebrates our differences. And so that requires a different kind of thinking. You know, somebody informed by the overview effect, somebody informed by psychedelic egoless rapture, somebody who's been moved by song. You know, I mean, it's a big thing that I'm looking, you know, for the person to be the storyteller of our times. You know, the people I tend to respect the most are filmmakers, because I think they tell the best stories. They tell the best stories through modern myths, which I think films are. Christopher Nolan, for example, his new film that he's making about, you know, Oppenheimer, I Am Become Death, you know, about the invention of the atomic bomb. I probably feel there's probably more relevance in this new film. I haven't seen it yet, but more relevance in this new film now as we face all these cataclysmic potential, you know, runaway effects with our technology, to watch a film about what happened. You know, when we really started to play God and discover atomic power, So again, long-winded answer, but I think it's storytellers, the right storytellers.
I'm very interested because you talk about movies, and I'm a strong believer in sociology of imagination, sociology of the imaginary. And actually, I believe we all live in imagination, so all we live in are common or shared imagination somehow. And those imagination or common imagination are stories, I agree with you, that we tell ourselves, tell in the story, in the families, in the countries, but they are coming a lot through movies, advertising, radio, songs, books. And when I see the movie industry, which for the Occidental world at least is made in Hollywood, mm-hmm. it's a lot about dystopian stories. Mm-hmm. They don't really make happy stories of technology. They don't really make happy stories of climate change.
Yeah.
They only talk about disasters.
Yeah.
Because that's what sells. People want to be afraid because they want to get prepared.
Yeah.
And the issue that I see is that if they were going to tell good stories, people will not come to the movie to see them. And so they have to tell bad stories for the people to come and make money.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. But I think, and this is something Jamie Weil also talked about in the conference, is that the best stories are actually the ones that initially are pre-tragic, then they're tragic, and then the post-tragedy is the triumph in the end, which is also the hero's journey that the mythologist Joseph Campbell famously isolated as a meta pattern that played out in every effective story. And I think it's because conflict leads to action. Action becomes a measure of our character, a measure of our courage. Do we rise to the occasion? Do we show up? Do we grow up when we need to before everything is going to go to hell? And so, and so in some ways, I think it's okay for cinema to be a place where we can imagine a rehearsal of these scenarios. We can play them out. I mean, isn't it better for these tragedies to play out cinematically and then for us to come together in the end to save the day? These are, in some ways, maybe it's like dreams. When we're dreaming, why do we have often nightmares and challenging dreams? We're working it out. We're playing things out. The mind is rehearsing scenarios and playing them out. That's in some ways, who knows, downloaded somatically into our into our instinctual body. But I still think that even when a film explores darkness or the shadow, it does so in a way that can be cathartic and bring us back to the light, you know. And I am biased because I love cinema. And I'm sure people could argue, you know, a different perspective. But
is it why, in a way, you made like short videos about science? Because it's easier to explain science in short videos than to make a big movie?
I went to film school and I double majored in philosophy and film. And the reason that I ended up falling into the short form storytelling, or the short films, as I call them, that I narrate, is because in some ways, I realized that what was happening with online distribution of content and online video is that people were consuming this media in a different way. So while a traditional film length works, you know, in a dark room when people are sitting quietly on a big screen, or maybe even at home on a big screen, when people are watching content on their phones or on their computer in between multitasking, like, you really only have them for a minute, for better or worse, you know. There's a lot of benefits, but also a lot of consequences to the amount of information inputs that people are receiving. And so I just kind of felt, well, I have maybe a minute, 2, 3 minutes, 4 minutes to see if I can get in there, to see if I can, you know, jolt a person into paying attention, into learning something. And it just so happens also that, like, in conversation, sometimes the greatest downloads, you know, might be like a 3-minute stream of consciousness that emerges mid-conversation. Boom. So that's my video. Like, my video is that. It's an aha moment, or a moment of reconciling opposites. You know, like, you have a thesis, you have antithesis, and then you have synthesis. I try to make my videos to be like that moment, the synthesis of an idea, the realization of an aha, and capture that at like a little video pill. And you can teach somebody a concept or an idea in 3 to 5 minutes. I really think you can, in a filmic way, in an emotional way. Yeah.
What is your process to do those videos? Do you prepare? Do you write something down that you learn by heart? How do you do it?
Yeah, good question. So it's funny because creative people, are always interested in like how to become more creative.
Yeah.
And in the marketplace for creativity is huge. There's a lot of consumerism around creative enterprising. How do I become more creative? What are the steps to becoming more creative? But I remember reading an article once that really resonated with my process, which was about like the key to creativity is mood regulation, you know? So it's not like, how do I become more creative? It's how do I become more joyful? How do I become more awake? How do I become more in tune? You know, mood regulation, for me at least, seems to be the key to creative outbursts. And so rather than plan what I'm going to talk about in a video, I make sure that I get a really good sleep and I plan the environment where I'm going to be. And I try to design a place that will inform a state of being that will give rise to a reflection shaped by that state of being. And so my videos, in some ways, are trip reports. They are like direct reflections of something that happened in the moment. That's why they're so of the moment. They're so real. They're so authentic, because you can't plan something like that. It's impossible. All you can do is set the stage and take a leap of faith.
What about boredom? Because boredom is a huge part of creativity also.
Yeah, funny you say that. There's a great essay written by a guy called Henry Weismeyer about the age of, he says, the search for awe, or the age of awe in the age of, the search for awe in the age of awesome. And one of the things that he said was that experience is the new faith, and we are refugees from the mundane. So we are running away from habituation. We are running away from boredom. You know, boredom is that feeling of low affect, mm-hmm. low engagement, low salience. And typically I only experience boredom when I haven't slept. It's really the only time that I'm bored, if I'm under-rested. If I had a really good sleep, I can pretty much beam my attention. I have the resources to beam my attention towards anything, and anything that you bring a certain quality of attention to becomes fascinating, you know? So, but yes, I mean, you have to seek novelty for sure. And now granted, frustration and boredom, yes, that can lead to creative bursts. Usually if there is boredom or any kind of frustration for me, it just makes me double down on making sure that tonight I get a really good sleep and tomorrow I go somewhere new and beautiful with a friend and get into it, you know, and wake up from that. Mm-hmm. So it ends up definitely being it lights a fire under your ass. Like, if I'm bored today, I do not want to be bored again tomorrow.
That's good.
Yeah.
Nice.
Because you were talking about creativity,
yeah.
And we were talking before about technology, I was wondering exactly what's a part also of how technology inspires your creativity.
Sure.
You did like a video that went on with AI that went viral.
Yeah.
So what are the tools you're using?
Sure.
When do you notice a technology and you say, oh, I'm going to use it? And,
yeah. Well, I think the first one that really got me excited was 8mm camcorder back in 1994. You know, like all of a sudden you could make movies with like the little video cassettes, and it was for consumers, not a professional film camera, but just a handheld camcorder. And my mom bought me one. It cost her $1,000, like 1994.
Wow.
And she was very generous, but she knew I loved movies. And she was like, if you're going to use this for a creative. And I started making videos with my brother. I could make movies, you know. And that was like 94. Who knows? I was 12, you know. And by the time I was like 14 or 16, I was making videos with my friends, interviewing each other about ideas. I was in love. And then I bought a dual deck VCR, which means I could transfer the footage from an 8mm tape to a VHS. And I could dub in music in the transfer. So without having any digital tools, I could still add music to my videos. So that was like a creative use of technology. I can make these music videos, edit them in my head, shoot them in sequence, and then just dub the music afterwards. And I was like, I have a music video. That was very exciting. And then in some ways I anticipated that these video cameras would get more and more sophisticated. I never quite anticipated that they would merge with an internet-enabled device, like a camera on a smartphone. Mm. But I already had a fantasy that a camera that fit in my hands, I could travel around the world, get inspired on the top of a mountain in Iceland and record a reflection about it. But then with things like the iPhone, my dream was literalized because now I could hold this device. You know, I was making selfie videos before the word selfie became the word of the year. Like, I was very ahead of my time in that sense, you know. But I've always creatively used these tools to up the ante of the cinematic power of my media. And then the latest iteration of this now is working with some of AI-powered visualization. So part of what I try to do in my videos is I want to bring people into the ineffable spaces of my inner world, the imagination, you know, which has its own dream logic. You know, it's like a dream. You can imagine the future and the past. You can imagine things that don't exist. You can hybridize things that don't exist with things that do exist, like all of that. And when you want to visualize that, there's traditional editing. You know, you source some stock footage, you cut away to imagery that's literally or metaphorically connected to what I'm talking about, and you can put people in a kind of trance, in a kind of dream. But now I can actually generate original imagery generated by AI-powered algorithms in combination with specific verbal prompts, mm-hmm. and run it through a rendering engine that will then bring original, like liquid imagination, rendering my thoughts visually around me in a way that is truly a kind of psychedelic experience. And I did a video about the power of AI art using this AI art, you know, and it's just insanely creative, in my opinion. I've never seen anything like it, even though I did it. And yeah, it's always just seeing like, what is the new thing and how can I use it to augment the storytelling? Because it's still about the story.
So do you think artists should or must use AI to be... not hub, but to continue with the time, like you could tell, like a writer should work with a computer, or a painter should work with Photoshop or whatever.
I think should or must are strong words. I think some people still love vinyl records, and that's beautiful. And I'm sure that there would be a premium placed on analog technologies for sure. But I think if you're inspired to pick up a new tool, like, you know, Kevin Kelly likes to say, imagine how impoverished all of us would be if the technology of oil painting didn't arrive in time for Van Gogh, or the technology of the musical instrument didn't arrive in time for Beethoven. So, like, these technologies, they increase our possibility space. And I don't know who or what form of genius or unique combination of person and tool will manifest, but I know that beautiful things will be created that we can scarcely imagine, and it would be a loss for that not to happen if those tools were not there.
Which one would you dream to happen as a filmmaker?
Oh my goodness. You know what would be kind of amazing would be, you know, fully immersive virtual reality. And I'm talking about something indistinguishable from like embodied experience of the world, like Neo in the Matrix, you know. But instead of seeing that as a prison, I sort of see that as a kind of psychedelic liberation, you know. I just imagine us like being able to like experience like flying, you know, like combining skinny dipping and flying through the sky, you know, in this virtual reality world, you know, where we can witness like star systems and black holes and wormholes all around. I mean, it'd just be really cool to swim inside of like this kind of cinematic universe that's fully 3D and fully surrounding us. I've always dreamed about fully immersive virtual reality. Like, I want to go into the screen.
That's making me think of a Steven Spielberg movie.
Yeah,
Ready Player One,
for sure. We're still waiting. Yeah.
I was asking you earlier if you read Viktor Frankl's book, A Man's Search for Meaning. You talk about optimalism. I don't know if you're familiar with
optimatism?
Optimalism.
Oh, optimalism. Yes. Tell me what it is.
So, because what he was saying is, the story is that he wrote the book after being in a concentration camp in Germany. And what he noticed is the people that were super optimistic die, because they thought that, you know, we'll be out in the winter, like for December we'll be out. and mm-hmm. they were not. And mm-hmm. so eventually they die because of their, they were hopeless eventually. And then you have wow. the pessimist people.
Yeah.
And the pessimist people commit suicide because they're like, yeah, there's no hope. It's done. It's over. We're not yeah. going to make it. Da, da,
yeah.
da, da, da.
Yeah.
And then in, do you have what he call optimalism, which is being optimistic, but realistic at the same time. Meaning like, yes, it's going to be hard. It's going to be long. We're going to suffer, but we're going to make it. And that is optimalism. And I was wondering what you think about that concept.
It's a beautiful word, optimalism. I mean, it parallels the definition, I think, of protopian versus utopian.
Somehow.
So yeah. the utopian is naive and Pollyanna-ish and believes everything is perfect no matter what and will be perfect no matter what. And the protopian says, we can make things real perfect, but we're going to have to work together. I think optimalism definitely lands for me. I mean, look, sometimes the improbable can become manifest, but I think it's good to have one foot in, one foot out, you know, to live in both worlds, you know, to dream, you know, to see the power of poetry, to dream the impossible dream and so on and so forth. But, you know, we need mathematics, we need engineering, we need science. Like, things have to be feasible, you know. And so, yeah, that lands for me.
Perfect.
And what does it mean for you, radical hope? How do you explain it?
Yeah, I love the term radical hope. And I think radical hope is what happens after radical healing and radical wonder and radical technology. That was my thesis in my talk
okay.
that I gave today, which was, you know,